You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry. This is Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM, and I'm your host, David Gilmore, with poet Derek Sheffield. We're going to turn to your newer collection, Not For Luck. You could read one or two of these in a series, if you wish. Timid as any herd animal is the opening poem of Not For Luck. And I think that's a great place to begin. Then.
Timid as any herd animal. That bright of the blue sky variety, raising every racket of mower and blower, backhoe and whacker, not to mention every street's hatch of after-school slammers and high-pitched trampoliners. Oh, just a while longer, a day, maybe three. Give them a rest. Have the hammocks hold fast and the bark remain in the dog. Have the thinnest veil of dusk, fog, or drizzle call stillness near, her sister silence here.
What we all need from time to time. We are surrounded by so many noises and sounds that can interfere, some that we don't mind, a bird song in the morning and things of that sort, but yeah, the blowers and the backhoes and the whackers, but call stillness near, and stillness is sister silence. It could be whispered.
This poem as a the lead poem as a kind of invocation for the book makes me smile a bit, because it's starting the book like this. Shh. And then it's words, 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 right?
Yes. Sound them out. Let them rip.
I like the irony of it. I like the irony of saying shh, and then, you know, going on and
out. Then out loud come the words. Yeah. Well, you hope perhaps out loud sometimes in your readers. Poems are often looked at, and then maybe as a reading heard, but. It's good for, I think, any poet who is a poet to read aloud others' poems to get that music out of them, you know. You have to get that sound ringing. Not just the meaning of words, not just the decoding of the word in your head, but through the ear, through the solar plexus.
Through the solar plexus. I like that. That should be a title to a craft book.
Well, Hitch, I found this one interesting, to even for the fact that you don't capitalize your title here. It's a lowercase hitch. This one could have a description just of the word hitch itself. But let's read this, and you can explain a little bit about your design of it later.
Hitch. This ceaseless going you follow when you follow a stream back into the hills, pearls and moils, wrinkles into flats, its glassy aim breaking to reshape every slope it is bound to flow and crumple, each try to make sense of whirl and glint and hold it. What's this gliding your way on that lit skin but a white dab of a day moth stuck up side down, wings full spread, and legs like sutures, crookedly struggling. And you, who have seen this many times, this time are grabbing for a stick to reach with and miss and stumble and miss and again and stumble jog to try once, no, twice more before you lift it dripping into the air, even as you catch a glimpse of yourself in the streaming sheen, holding a bite-sized hitch in earth's weft. For you do not stop your dimpled twin from swiping it onto your finger and peering into the pin-pricked black of its globed eyes, which must see you multitudinously, the you who has killed and eaten and licked his greasy fingers, the you who has hurt others and borne grudges, and the you who will again. And this one, who walks upstream to the tallest pine tree in sight to divert a little life, for once, at least this one, onto the bark where it crawls, wing-shivered, into one of the many furrows, puzzling its way up past how many flakes and branches, breaking how many rays of light and how many needles, flaring all the way up to where a wisp of cloud in the whole blue sky floats.
Yeah. You're saving a creature again. And just as you allowed the stuffed blackbird to see again, having taken the dust off his little beady eyes, you have also looked into the pinprick black of its globed eyes, which must see. Yes, you're very good with moments that are echoes of other works. I've noticed that as I read through the whole collection. You don't let it always rest. You can keep that, and you can use that again in another slightly different way, to a different effect, of course, too. Now, tell us about it. Tell us about Hitch, about the form of it.
This is another, what you would say, concrete poem. And once again, the form came from the process of its making. It suggested itself. And the stanzas are indented all across the page so that as you look at them, they wind and wend their way down the page, much like a creek or a river. And it was actually a reader, too, who pointed out something I hadn't thought about, that it also reminded them of the furrows in the bark of a tree, as well of a big ponderosa pine tree, say, for example. That's what I'm hoping for there, what I had in mind for sure. The other thing that's interesting about this poem to me is that also in the making of it, it seemed to want to have nearly no conventional punctuation. I think maybe none. And as you know, I typically rely on conventional punctuation and grammar. Those are some, you know, limitations that I'm happy to take on. Mm-hmm. But this poem wanted to keep going. And so I think it was a challenge to myself as I was writing it. Can I sustain this? Can I maintain the sense of it and not lose too many people along the way as I let that ongoingness be in the language?
And the title, you used it in the poem to describe the bite-sized hitch in Earth's web. Hitch, again, is one of those words like keep. There's a fastening that goes on with it. It's an attaching. You didn't capitalize the hitch. It's left just as a italics, lowercase, which, again, fits perhaps with your desire not to punctuate, to make this a little bit of an oddball poem.
Exactly.
But descriptive, too, of the meandering of a stream, as you say, and perhaps the staggering of the person that might be walking the stream, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you've ever walked in a river, there's a fair amount of staggering going on.
We have some of the ecology now of the home life. Ecology can be a study of the great planets, our home, but also the house and the home that you live in. Again, you've got the daughter and father relationship in this one, and it's winter time. Daughter and father in winter.
This book, Not for Luck, if it had a subtitle, it would be something like On Daughters and Other Wild Things. And actually, it seems entirely appropriate, entirely reasonable, and makes perfect sense that a consciousness drawn to the wildness of a day moth or a red-tailed hawk or a trout would also be drawn to that same kind of wildness that lives in our children. So this is Daughter and Father in Winter. "Clap like this," she says, and we clap the stuttering snaps of the kindling coming to life in the stove we have scooted close to play the game she makes as the fire goes. "Raise your arms," and we move like flames, waving hello and goodbye to the snow outside our windows. "Now close your eyes," and she gets us to bunch ourselves into balls and hold tight inside the heat's growing belly. "Don't peek," and I don't stop peering into the dark. Silence. Ash. "Look, it's snowing in my eyes." "Yes," I say, opening mine, "and I'm starting to freeze." She opens her eyes and sees the frost in my beard. Her laughter ignites another fire.
Excellent depiction of a really intimate relationship and the inside of the eye. How it goes on the inside, in the cones and rods, and very, very, very interesting way of going inward there. That's one of your beauties, is it not?
That poem I think of as a gift of paying attention. For sure, my modus operandus is greatly influenced by William Stafford, who said that, you know, we are all living in our lives like rivers, and, you know, things are going by us all the time. But poets, you know, artists will reach out and, you know, try and grab a bit of that up and hold it up for inspection and want to linger with it a little longer. So this is just a gift of paying attention to the daughters. I think with the wood stove, with the fire and the winter landscape, I don't know if I've realized this before, but now that I'm thinking about it with you, I'm sure that back of this poem, and because it's a father and a child and it's winter, and I'm sure that one of the poems that I love so deeply and that I've had memorized for, you know, 20 or 30 years, that helped make my poem possible is Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. You know, Sundays too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue black cold.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see that. Yeah, how we sometimes do get the stimulus from another's works and are able to put it in our own world. Yeah.
I ask my students to memorize poems still, and I guess I'm a bit old school in that regard. I don't think of it as old school. I think of it as you know, good school. And, you know, we all sit around together and say our poems. But, you know, this was something that one of my teachers, David Wagner, said too, is that, you know, they will help you. And you won't even know it, but they'll help you. That is exactly right.
That's right. And so we glister forward, we slugs, as we go on to Spirit Lake. And this is not such a nasty fish form. This is science at work. And I think this one is close to many who live in Washington, who have lived here in the last 40 years, close to Mount St. Helens. Let's read about the science of Spirit Lake.
It's the water's pulse through line and rod that jutters in his hands, in fish after fish, whip-thrashed into air, into arms and body and day's heat, all day, day after day, all summer, and into the net, where she stands to her waist in the lake's cool sway, and the lake in lit wrinklings letting go as she wades their catch to shore and quickly kneels and lays it flat to her measured board, pinned beneath her sun-lined hands as she bends to sex, clip, and scrape while keeping it alive, gills fluttering like the dream-caught eyes of children, before she turns and splashes back. And each, as she stops to let her arms fall open, hangs there as if unable to let go of her grasp or remember its own truth of unnumbered shadows. When the life from who knows where comes finally, shudderingly back, and it shiver flits away, a few scales are left to slowly tumble and flash and become like the clear seconds it takes to watch them, indistinguishable from the restless body that holds them.
The keeping and the letting go. The keeper, keeper that you caught before was something of a nasty experience altogether. That was a keeper that should have been let go too, a hen that had been clipped, right? And this is about the clipping and the marking of fish, but the letting go, and such a gentle, careful letting go from a grasp. Many have noticed, I suppose, when they let a fish loose, how it hangs there for that moment, thinking, I don't have to go anywhere. He let me go. I'm here. I'm in my environment. And then the flitter, and this, off they go, dashing away usually, happy to be back in their environment. Yeah, it's a very tender poem about scientists at work being as kind as they can, as they're able to be. So you were part of this experience and experiment with someone at Spirit Lake?
There are many people who would envy me tremendously for having fished in Spirit Lake, which you cannot do because it is the monument is was designated in 1980 a place of research. It's one big experiment that we are carefully observing. This is long-term ecological research going on at the Mount St. Helens. Two or three times now, I think I've had the chance to spend about a week living on those slopes and accompanying scientists of different flavors, fisheries, ornithology, botany, into the field. And this is the Spring Creek Project out of, which is a partnership between Oregon State University and the Forest Service, and I think the U.S. Geological Society might be in there as well. You know, essentially it's been my job to provide an artistic response to accompany the scientific ones. In other words, this is artistic data to accompany the quantitative data. I do think of this as an homage to science and scientists as well. And one reader kind of surprised me when she read this and she said, "Oh, thank you so much for honoring female scientists." And I hadn't even thought of it that way, you know, which I take to be a really lovely thing that I was like, "Oh yeah, I guess that's right." I mean, I was just like, okay, yeah, I guess that's still a thing. I mean, it of course shouldn't be, but yeah, I mean, it's such a gift and I have so much admiration. So I can go out there for a week and sort of, you know, play around and then write about it. But these people, mm-hmm. I mean, it is hard work to go out there throughout the whole research season and be doing that work. It takes an incredible kind of dedication. And I so admire that.
Yes. Well, when we spoke about the naturalists the other day, Peter Foley, and I mentioned Mervyn Sheldrake, Robert McFarland. I really should have mentioned Susan Simard to you, who you probably know the name of and her work very well because of the studies she did to encourage even the use of metaphors like communication of trees, which at time was a very difficult metaphor to take hold. Scientists didn't like that too much. It is one of her phrases, and of course, Wood Wide Web, that she also coined, I think.
Oh my God, she's the Jane Goodall. She's the Diane Fossey of trees, of the plant world.
Yes.
And she's astonishing. Her work, finding the mother tree, and then her work as it influenced Richard Powers' novel, The Overstory, and also the work of Robin Wall Kimmerer and her mm-hmm. Braiding Sweetgrass. She was another person who contributed an incredibly powerful letter for the Dear America book, Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Oh, there you are.
Native scientist, an incredible person, a bridge person, someone we need so desperately, who is a PhD in botany and also a native scientist. And but, you know, all these people have come along. Actually, my first experience, though, with these things wasn't through Simard's work or these folks, but it was, I think it was like 17, 18 years ago now when I was the first time I went to Mount St. Helens to work with these people, scientists who had been there since 1980, going back year after year, doing their research. And I remember in particular these two guys, one of them who taught at Oregon State University. I was eavesdropping. He was talking to my friend John Daniel, another terrific poet, naturalist, and novelist, essayist, kind of does it all, describing how they were digging down through the tephra, the soil, the volcanic soil there, and tracing out the mycorrhizal filaments. Oh, God, a work of such incredible delicacy that it just immediately wants to touch your heart, you know?
Mycelial matter is becoming quite well known and will be perhaps part of the saving of our planet in time. And mycorrhizal studies have been all part of that. We're lucky to have people looking into rock, into the soil, trying to figure out what dirt is, and finding that it's more than just inorganic stuff.
I go back and think about one of my early poems, like How We Look. I didn't have the language for it then, but what I see that it's doing and what's happening in so many of the other poems that we've looked at is that it's giving agent, it's acknowledging the agency of these other beings. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I was just following the poems and where they wanted to go in my feelings, right? But now I know that I have for a long time been living in the world as described by Thomas Berry, this beautiful eco-theologian who says that the cosmos is not a collection of objects, but a communion of subjects. That's it.
I think poems are stepping stones to so many different subjects, and to have certain words in them that strike a reader at some point in their lives as new or unusual. Maybe they go and look it up in the dictionary for the first time and then realize this word's everywhere. It's in all kinds of magazine articles. It's in books. What have I been missing? And maybe it shows up in a poem for the first time. Maybe it's heard out loud for the first time. Goes through the ear. You're doing a service here. Service of recording your family life among so many things. And we'll go to first grade with your daughter here. Again, backtrack a wee bit.
Ah, yes. Back to those other wild things. First grade. Sunday afternoon, and she looks up from her drawing, wants to know if I know the game where you put your head down and thumb up until someone picks you. Yes, I say, across the room and half listening. Well, I always pick my friends, but they never pick me. I pause in the middle of a sentence. Who are your friends? Everyone, she says, as if I had asked 1 + 1 or the color of the sky. Sunlight draws a skewed rectangle across the floor. I see, I say, and let my notebook close, seeing children in rows, heads on desks, her big ears poking through sandy hair, listening for a step or a breath. Yes, I remember that game. And I stand and walk over to find the outline of her hand plunging through a white sky.
Yeah, she took you away from your work just for the experience of a first grader. That's the way it happens, isn't it? You have to remember that game. Yeah, we forget so much of the games that we played. In fact, I know when I get together with some old timers, we talk about games that nobody ever plays anymore. And that we thought was the game of the day, that everybody has to play this one. And yet, as we grow, we forget those things. So you bring it back again. Another stepping stone there to the life of a young child. Learning how to be a friend among friends in school. So we could see. And once more, we go out into the country to at least imagination of our country place and what we make of it.
And this is another one that comes about thanks to the Spring Creek Project and my association and affinity for scientists. And there is this need in our culture for an increased scientific literacy. even an artistic one, so we could see. If we mapped this mountain creek's channel over many seasons of spill and flood, gravel and jam, we could play those maps back like the flip pictures we drew in rooms of another age, to let one more hour slip by. And we could see, without a doubt, that jabbed snake writhe before our eyes, and would hear, of course, not a sound in such a scream. While in our cities, bright glasses of iced water, like nothing, kept appearing across tabletops.
What we don't see in a glass of ice water placed in front of us that we let sit undrunk. And yet you put it into the picture of how long it takes for a stream to come about, become a river, become a great flood and whatnot. And water is taken, has been taken so much for granted, but I think we're slightly changing people's minds on that one. At least Californians are learning a thing or two about it. And we must too.
I was just talking to a friend the other day who lives in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And he was saying that they're about out of water. And I think there was maybe some efforts to figure out how were they were going to get water to their town. I know that they have to transport water to Tucson, Arizona, to support that population.
Do you think that they have to just leave some of those places?
It does beg the question, why are humans there anyway? Why are we there? It's going to be a combination of that kind of thing and also rising temperatures in the next couple of decades, actually, when we will start seeing migrations happening. This poem, actually, you know, you mentioned the childhood games that first grade refers to, but this poem has one of those at its heart as well. And, you know, this is sort of this strange kind of silly association that I had as I was listening to this scientist friend describe what they've been doing with this creek and, you know, part of the long-term ecological reflection and mapping it and so forth. And, you know, one of my first associations was, were those little pictures that we drew. And it was kind of silly and maybe a little stupid even. My friend Ellen Bass quotes, I think it's D.H. Lawrence who advises us to embrace our strange angels. And I think this was embracing a strange angel here in letting that association get me to this mute scream in the poem.
What sound is uttered by the silent scream? It's often shown in films as an image of a horrific face, unable to say anything cogent or intelligent, but just has to be that open mouth trying to utter whatever sound would say the horror of it, the terror of it. How can one make that sound? So, and you've picked it out there right before the water comes to the table. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much, Derek. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, David. It's been such a pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma with poet Derek Sheffield, and I've been your host, David Gilmore.